make a kind of introduction to a beautiful example of a bacterial circuit. And if you remember from the previous lecture, we were talking about the motor. This is the last operons that are made are can code genes to tell the bacteria where to go. And this is called the chemotaxis, and I'll tell you, it's one of the best characterized, really, circuits in biology where people know the most about the components and the behavior and the link between the components and the behavior, and still we don't know enough, but it's really a very interesting place to start to learn a lot about principles of how signal transduction systems work in general. So this is a phenomenon called bacterial chemotaxis. So the bacteria swim. Now imagine you take a dish of bacteria. They're swimming around. You take a pipette, which has a specific chemical that is an attracted chemical. This is, could be an amino acid the bacteria like aspartate or serine. And you stick it into the plate. The observation is the bacteria comes to the pipette, form a visible cloud.
On time scale of?
That's a little minutes. It depends. If you look under a microscope, you can see a response in tenths of a second. Very fast. On the other hand, if you take this dish of bacteria and you put it in a pipette that has poison in it, repellents, there's a whole lot of different ones. The ion, nickel ions, the amino acid leucine, everything bad, ethanol, you know, the bacteria go run away. So this is chemotaxis. Like in Greek, the bacteria like halotaxin, they go towards chemicals. So how do they perform this feat? Basically what they're doing is detecting spatial gradients. I think we should close it?
Yeah, then I'm gonna water.
Yeah, maybe you
I just wanted some oxygen. Or maybe one of them.
It's kind of fair.
It's the most beautiful place ever to give a talk.
Yeah, it's also a beautiful
view. Or maybe you should keep it open. I don't know.
You can still
see.
5 of 1.
Half.
5 of 1. That's kind of thing. It's
the sea breeze is coming in. Okay, so how does the bacteria, basically it's computing. It's computing and it's moving up spatial gradients of chemicals. So how does it do this? And this was, the answer was found in 1972, Howard Berg, classic paper. Berg and Brown. Where they build a tracking microscope that follows the bacteria. It keeps it in focus in 3D. It turns out bacteria make a three-dimensional random walk, just without any gradients, not just. Bacteria make a three-dimensional random walk. So they're swimming along at 20, 30 microns per second. And their motion consists of basically two kinds of motion. One is a kind of straight motion, it's affected by Brownian motion. So every 10 seconds or so, if they turn to swim straight, they'll turn 90 degrees. That's called a run. And they're punctuated by these events called tumbles, where the bacterium stops swimming, changes direction, and then chooses a new direction at random. And then, so the typical runs are about a second, 2 seconds. Tumbles take about a tenth of a second. Right? So it's swimming, swimming. Mechanistically, to connect this to the motors we were talking about before. It turns out that the motors, they can turn either clockwise or counterclockwise. When the motors are turning counterclockwise, flagella have a pitch, and what they do is they assemble into a bundle that propels the cells forward. That's a run. However, when motors turn counterclockwise, there's an amazing phase transition that occurs in the flagellum. The pitch changes, and since you have two, from the end, since you have two coexisting helices of different pitch, they have to form an angle. This angle breaks the bundle apart. It's a very complicated mechanics. So what happens? When it's clockwise, the flagella are like this. And this is the tumble. So what's regulating this motion is the fraction of time that motors are being counterclockwise or clockwise.
What does it do when it has one flagellum?
I don't know. But there are other species which have only one flagellum, and what they do is run and stop. Run and stop. And when they stop, thermal motion, that's also the viable way. Okay, so this is just behavior without gradient. So how does it go up a gradient? Or run away from gradient? How does it go up a gradient of attracting? Or run away from repellents, right? So here, the mechanism is, it's simply by changing frequency of these tumbles. So the idea is like this. When the bacterium senses, what it's doing is it's not measuring the gradient over space, over its body, it's just too small. It's measuring temporal gradients. So what it does is it moves, and if the concentration of attractant increases with time, it lowers the frequency of tumbles. And thus, on average, tending to continue to move in the right direction. Whereas if it's going down the gradient, the concentration of attractant decreases with time, it increases the tumbling frequency. Therefore, increasing the chance of moving in a different direction. A very simple strategy that works on average, so that, here's the gradient, here we have our pipette. Bacterium, when they move up the gradient, they tend not to change direction. They're moving not up the gradient, to change direction more often until they find a way up the gradient. It's a stochastic process. And when you look at a single bacterium moving up the gradient, you don't see. It's like one of those, like an electron problem where they're moving all over the place, but they have a slight bias to go towards, that gives you a current. It's small, but it works. Okay. So it runs and tumbles, and the output of the system, let's say, is tumbling frequency, which is number of tumbles per second, right? You can think about that as input is a concentration as a function of time of the attractant or repellent. Yeah.
When it tumbles, it forgets about the history totally. It just randomly chooses a direction, or.
Yeah, that doesn't use in this paper, they do very nice statistics that the tumbles are correlated with the previous system. In fact, there's a slight bias towards forward scattering, but it doesn't depend on history. And also, the distribution of times when they tumble is an exponential distribution. A lot of the nice facts like this. Okay, so it's a random walk with the tumbles. So, here in the lab, is a typical experiment to measure the input-output relationship of bacterial phenotaxis. And what you do is you build an experiment, I'll tell you about the experiment soon, where you're measuring tumble per second as a function of time, or let's say a population of bacteria, the average tumble. You get some signal, about one tumble per second. And suppose at this time point here, you make a step addition of attractant. Right? You add attractants to this population. So the response is very rapidly the bacteria stop tumbling. In fact, what they do is you put in this attractant. They're running, tumbling, and when you put in the attractant, whatever, they just stop tumbling, they swim. They're not swimming in any particular direction because there's no gradient. You just dumped in a ton of pressure. And then, on a slower time scale, they adapt. And despite the fact that there's a lot of attractants around, they return to their pre-stimulus level. Right?
And the pre-stimulus level simulates an unbiased random walk?
There's no unbiased random walk. It's also an unbiased random walk here. And there's no gradients in this experiment. This is an artificial situation where we're just dumping.
I mean, there's temporary delta function time gradient when you dump the attractant block.
You mean, depends how you do it, if you're well mixed or not. But
it's not a spatial gradient at all, but I'm saying.
A temporal gradient.
Yeah
right. No,
back
exactly.
Here.
So what is
creating a real temporal gradient?
Yeah, there's a real temporal gradient.
We interpret as a spatial gradient.
I agree, precisely. So what this experiment is doing is showing that they actually, what this is doing is it's like a filter, it's measuring a temporal gradient, and then adapting. It's following minus the derivative of this function somehow.
That's a computation with zero attractant, right?
Well, either you start from zero attractant or you start from some level to which you adapt.
Okay,
and then you add more. There's a limit where you set, there's a saturating limit where they can't respond anymore, and that's when they saturate all the receptors. Well, I'll talk about this limit. But in a wide range, and within a wide range, it's five orders of magnitude of concentration. Tremendous range. They're able to respond and adapt. Five orders of magnitude. Okay, so let's put some time scales. This response here is order of 0.1 seconds. And this adaptation time here ranges from second to 10 minutes, depending on the size of the stimulus. The bigger the stimulus, the longer it takes it to adapt.
And whilst adapting for 10 minutes, what's the stumble frequency?
Zero.
Really zero.
Another feature that's interesting is that it has exact adaptation. That is to say, it doesn't go back here, or it doesn't go back here. The steady state level is independent of the steady state input level. It has exact adaptation. Now, I have to say that in sensory systems, this is what you generally see in biology. For example, think about our eyes going from the outside into a dark theater. Something like that. First, we can't see anything. Slowly, our eyes adapt, and we can see small changes in contrast. It's a response and adaptation, somehow, of our sensory system. Same thing E. coli is doing here. It's presumably adapting, so now that if we make another step change, it can respond. This doesn't explain why it adapts precisely, but it's the adaptation in general. It does adapt precisely, though. That's the experimental adaptation.
But the direction it actually goes down is because the concentration goes up.
Yeah, that's right.
If the concentration goes down, you know.
Now, if I did the same experiment by subtracting attractants, it would go up and then down. Right? If you take away attractants, it perceives it as going down the gradient, and therefore you tumble more. So this is the basic computation, if you want, performed by the bacteria.
Did you write the adaptation time as 1 second to 10 minutes?
1 second to 10 minutes.
So it can vary between.
Right, it depends on the size of the stimulus. It's small stimuli, it's seconds. And it's saturated stimuli, it's minutes.
And if I slowly drip in attractants, so there's a slow temporal gradient increase.
Yeah, actually, people did experiments like that when they made an exponential ramp of attractants.
Will it and adapt out?
What happens then is that it's. It kind of locks. It locks to the attractants. I can give you a paper on that, please. Okay, so this is our input-output relationship, and we talked about swimming, running, and tumbling. So now let's go inside the cell and try to understand what are the genes, proteins, that perform this computation. So go inside the cell and look at the proteins. So there's six proteins in principle that perform this computation, and I'll try to just explain this system. And of course, I have to say that this phenomenology was started in 1967 by a great biologist called Adler, who bacteria swimming was observed by Levin, who invented the microscope in some bacteria. He wrote to the Royal Academy. One of the most pleasing sights in my life is these little creatures swimming around. And they loved it, right? The chemotaxis was discovered around 1880, when people took leaves, put them under the microscope, and they made little drops of oxygen after photosynthesis, and bacteria chemotaxis aerotaxed to the oxygen. And it was forgotten, basically, until 1967, when Adler said, okay, here's an example of a sensory system in bacteria, and it took a long time to prove that they're actually sensing and not just eating the thing and moving. And he discovered the first genes, and after this, great biologists like Howard Berg, Mel Simon, and others just did the genetics and discovered this beautiful little computer that and brought it to the level of understanding that's very close to where you can start, has meat, where you can start doing theory on it. Okay, so here's the first part of the course. This is the cell. This is the motor that we love enough in the previous lecture, right? Spinning either clockwise or counterclockwise. Okay, so the first, the most important component is the receptor. Now, this receptor is a protein that's stuck in the membrane itself, the inner membrane of the core. And half of it is outside and half of it is inside. It's a goal, role is to transmit information from the outside to the inside. On the outside, it has a binding pocket that's specific for the attractants molecules. So the attractants bind specifically here. They bind and unbind on time scales of milliseconds.
How many of them are there?
And there's an order of 1,000 copies of these receptors around
the cell. And is the one closest to the motor the one that's most important for that motor, or is the diffusion of the amount of
diffusion is very fast. For instance, this receptor is, and other membrane proteins can go around the cell in a tenth of a second. But it's recently been discovered that a lot of the receptors are clumps, cell poles. It's not clear why. And some models, there's not some model that is considered cluster of receptors and posit that they interact with each other like an Ising model, therefore amplifying the effect of one binding sub-event. It's not proved. Okay, so what is it like? Simple things. This is a receptor. The receptor is associated with two proteins. One of them is an adapter, another one is a kinase. Kinase means that it can take an add a phosphate group to second protein, right? It's difficult. The second protein called QI is a response regulator. This is a two-component system, like I talked to you, I mentioned in the first talk, receptor and messenger. So this receptor adds a certain range of phosphate groups to QI, and another enzyme, QZ, takes them away. So there's a certain level of QI with this phosphate on it. And this QI with phosphate on it has a bit of information on it. Only when it has this phosphate on it, it goes to the motor and changes the probability that the motor will be clockwise. So without QI, the motor is counterclockwise. The cells, if we take an experiment and delete QI, the cells are always swinging smoothly. When you add QI, the cells have QI, some of it will be phosphorylated. There will be some rate. It binds to the motor and affects the probability that the motor will be
clockwise. So only the phosphorylated one can bind to the motor.
Only phosphorylated ones can affect the motors. Yeah. And it's estimated that there's 30 binding sites for phosphorylated QI on each motor, and it's some kind of steep response between the phosphate and motor.
So you have to bind 30 of them, or?
What?
You have to bind 30?
No, it doesn't. There's 30 binding sites, but people don't know how many QIs you need to bind, but it's a very steep function, therefore it's probably, you need cooperative binding with several QI phosphates to activate.
So when it does bind to the motor, it just changes its...
It changes its... Well, I would say that there is a function that translates between the concentration of QI phosphate and the probability of the motor going clockwise. So it mechanistically, it probably binds preferentially to the clockwise state of the motor rather than the counterclockwise state, thereby thermodynamically increasing the probability of it to be in the clockwise state, the more QI there is. See, it looks like the whole motor is a huge protein ensemble that can click between two discrete conformations. But that's not, it's a subject of research how this switching is done. For our purposes, suffice to say that the more QI phosphate there is, the more tumbles there are. Okay, so now, what happens when we add to the external, we add attractants. We add attractants, like the amino acid aspartate. Aha, the bacteria now wants to stop running, to stop tumbling, because it thinks it's going in the right direction. There's suddenly a lot of aspartate, right? It wants to stop tumbling. So what it does, what happens is that once attractants bind to receptors, the receptors shut off the kinase that's associated with them, that's bound to them. And therefore, it shuts off, this X should be, it shuts off this phosphorylation. The enzyme QZ that takes away the phosphate group quickly gets rid of all the phosphates. And therefore, there's no more tumbles. See that? So when you put an attractant, it shuts off the enzyme, the kinase, no more phosphorylation, and the phosphate gets taken off quickly by QZ and the QZ, and therefore no more tumbles. And the bacteria swims, only run. The tumble frequency goes down to zero. They only run. Now, if this was all of the system, we would stay stuck here forever. Right? There will be no adaptation. So what brings adaptation? So there's an extra bit loop in this circuit, and this loop is this function. And really, the star here is this receptor. So not only can it bind tractin, it can also, it can be methylated on four different sites. Now, methylated, you can think of it the same as phosphorylated. It's a chemical group that's added covalently to the protein and changes its changes its behavior. So what is this methylating? You can think of it, the receptor is a kind of detector that has four buttons on it. The more buttons you push, that is, the more methyl groups you add, the more active the kinase becomes. So if you put on a tractant and you shut off the kinase in phosphorylation, you can now press buttons, add methyl groups, to restore the activity, to overcome the suppressions done by the tractant. So it's sensitizing your detector, right? And this is done on a slow time scale. This addition of methyl groups, this addition is done on a slow time scale by the last two chemotaxis proteins, KR and KB, where KR is an enzyme that adds these guys, and KB is an enzyme that removes them. And when there's no tractin around, there's always this kind of Sisyphean task of adding and removing methylation, adding and removing adding. There's always a flux. KR spends a lot of energy on this, and the methyl that's produced by itself, methanol, is primarily because of this process, adding and removing methyl groups. The thing is that there's a feedback loop where the more active the receptor is, it also phosphorylates this protein and makes it more active. Therefore, the more active the receptor is, the more active this enzyme is, the more methyl groups are removed, and the less active.
The more active it who is?
The more active the kinase is here, the more phosphorylation there is.
Okay.
It also phosphorylates KB.
Okay.
Therefore, the more active KB is, therefore, the more methyl groups are removed, therefore, the less active the receptor. It's a negative feedback loop. And in the textbooks, this is the picture that explains adaptation. You put on a tractant, activity goes down. Also, activity of demethylation goes down. There's methylation, methylation, methylation until you restore previous activity. These enzymes are responsible for the adaptation. For example, classic experiment, when you knock out these enzymes, it really does stay down forever.
This set of arrows and so forth doesn't explain why it's exact.
Exactly, that's precisely the point. It doesn't, in fact, that's exactly where a model can come in. And it turns out that, okay, that's the second part of the talk, precisely. So you see, this is a system where you know the components, you know a lot about the numbers on these arrows, these experiments, about the event rates of the different reactions. There's crystal structures even. There's measurements of the function that translates between how much phosphorylated KY there is and how much probability the motor spins counterclockwise. There's data on the binding coefficients here, and a lot of data. It's about an opus of 200 papers that you can read through and summarize in a set of differential equations, describe the system. Okay, so that links the behavior to what's happening inside the cell. Okay, all right. So now. We use the system. Now I'm going to talk about the work that I did when I was a postdoc together with Stan Leibler and Naama Balkai. He's a great theorist who's now started up a lab at Weizmann. And Mike Surette. And we took this network and we used this as an example to ask the following question. We want to ask the following question. We have a computation done by a network. How much does this computation depend on variations in the reaction rate constant, the numbers on the arrows, and the concentrations of different proteins in the system? So you're given, the cell makes 200 copies of KY, 300 copies of KB, 400. And you always imagine that these are numbers you can sticking to your special equations, and you get a system. But in fact, like we said in the previous time, there's cell-to-cell variations in everything. So the numbers of the proteins, when you change temperature and things like that, the rate constants can change. So, how much of this function is dependent on fine-tuned parameters, and how much of it is robust to changes? And how can you build a mechanism that's robust to changes? So you can imagine there's two extreme possibilities. One is that you have a circuit that's really, you have to keep, if there's 500 of protein X, there has to be 1,000 of protein Y, otherwise it'll fail. It's fine-tuned. Another extreme is a mechanism that's robust, in which you can vary any of the parameters in a wide range and still keep the essential behavior of the circuit. Now I'm going to make it a little bit more concrete. In particular, is what just what you asked, this exact adaptation, this feature where the steady state level doesn't depend on the input level, is a non-trivial feature to capture in a model. And there's been, well, before I say this, I have to say that this question of robustness was raised several times in the century in biology, in the 30s, when people were wondering about the development of organisms. And in the 70s, Michael Savageau in Ann Arbor wrote that this is an important question when you're looking at metabolic systems. And an experimentalist called Katzel in the 70s and 80s did experiments on varying concentration of different metabolic enzymes and noticed that the flux through the circuit was insensitive to them. So there's a history of this question of robustness. Here we're trying to ask it on a signal transduction circuit. So
the adaptation time is definitely not robust.
Yeah, we finished the talk. Good, it's precise. Some features, of course, when you change parameters, things will change. But some feature of the computation is, so it turns out that people use the system to, because it's so well characterized, to try to write these differential equation models, which capture a lot of the dynamics. And usually, what you do, you end up with a model of differential equation that does this, and you're happy that it works. Okay? But when you analyze these models, it turns out that to get exact adaptation, you have to tune the parameters. And if you instead of 500 of this protein and 1,000 of this, you have to say there's 550, then this doesn't adapt exactly. This property of exact adaptation is fine-tuned. There's mechanisms, I would even say in some sense, the simplest mechanisms you can think of, based on the known biochemistry, are fine-tuned. And the point in general that I want to make, this is a point that was discovered by Nama Bakari and Dan Langler in a paper, I think, in 1997. It just pointed out that you can take the same facts known from biochemistry and build two different models for the same phenomenon, and they're different. In one model, this feature of exact adaptation is fine-tuned. Change the parameters. And there's one particular class of models that's very unusual and makes biochemical predictions are very specific, where this feature is robust. That is to say, when you change the parameters, the steady state level can change. The adaptation time can change, but you still return to the same steady state before that. Everything changes except for this feature that the steady state is independent of the input level. And I have here slides that I'm going to skip, that outline the difference between these fine-tuned and robust mechanisms. We can get to them in the end. All right. But what I did when I came to the lab is I set up to do an experiment to decide, to actually see in real bacteria what happens when you change parameters, this computation. In particular, what happens when you change the levels of proteins that are involved in this network. And see what happens. Is it really fine-tuned or robust? What features are fine-tuned? Which features are robust? So you following the idea? Okay, so the experiment had two parts. The first part was to measure this, a system that can measure this pretty accurately. And the second part was the molecular genetics experiment where genetically engineered E. coli, so we have experimental knobs where you can turn the knob and change the concentration inside the cell of each of the different proteins in the network. And again, like I said in the first talk, you grow them to the point in growth where they mate with each other and they're optimally swimming. And you take them and you put them in between the two glass slides in a situation where you're making a 2D bacteria gas. So they're swimming in 2D in about a 10 micron thick layer. And the reason is because you want to keep them all in the focal plane of the microscope. So they never swim out of view. And you photograph them with a microscope. And you can see hundreds of bacteria at a time, running and tumbling. And you take these images, which have very high contrast, and you do image analysis to track all these cells moving. And you compute the average tumbling frequency over the population. Okay. So, for example, this is what some seconds of motion look like. Here's a field of view, and each ellipse here is a bacterium, some of which are stuck to the glass. And you filter these out during the analysis. And here's a bacterium that ran, swam, and tumbled. Right? Now, I just want to make a point here that we'll return to in the end. When you look under the microscope at these individual organisms, even though they're genetically identical, there's a range of behaviors. If you compare this cell to this cell here is very relaxed. It's going to run, running for a second, tumbling, running, tumbling. This cell here is very nervous. And happy. So even though they're all genetically identical, they have these characters that persist over long times, you know, 10, you measure this for an hour, they persist over long times, and they're not genetic origin. We'll come back to this point in the end. Okay, but this kind of experiment allows us to measure this curve, where we add at certain points saturating amount of attractant, and measure and see that they're swimming smoothly and then adapting. Okay. The second part of the experiment was...
So this is true in our individual...
In individual cells.
This statement you're making is true.
Yeah, this
even though individual could vary in the order of magnitude.
So one cell would look like this, swim smoothly, and then look like this. They have a lot of fluctuations also here.
Each have bacteria.
Yeah, but each one responds. They all do chemotaxis. They all respond. But the steady state of another cell could be here.
Right.
So the another cell could be here. Right?
That steady state persists for the rest of the cell.
The steady state, the individual cell has its own slow time scale.
What time scale is that? That's for many generations.
No, many generations. It's probably tens of minutes. 10 minutes.
each cell, do I understand correctly, each cell has a different tumble per second idle rate to which it adapts exactly?
Yeah, right.
This is something you know? I mean, you measured... If you measured only averages for populations, then you then could...
I measured, and also other people measured it. And basically taking cells and catching a flagella and gluing it to the glass, and then what happens is the cell body rotates, not the flagella, but the cell body. But there you can see clockwise and counterclockwise rotation. It's another assay. Looking at individual cells like this, this experiment's done many times. You add a set function, and you see that at an individual cell level, you have this. When you average over a single cell, right, each experiment, there's a lot of noise. And when you average on the same cell over, let's say, 10 experiments, we get a perfect thickness with exactly the same.
But a property which is robust is evidently not robust between cells.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not that. No. The property of robustness is returning to the same state of state. The state itself is not robust. The state itself varies between cell to cell.
The lengths of the cells are all the same. The tails are all the same.
Excuse me?
The lengths of the tail.
No.
Would that play a role in the difference?
It would play a role in the swimming speed, but probably not in the coming frequency.
So after it divides, the daughters have pheromone baselines?
I don't know, but that's a good question to look at experimentally. See, like if this nervous cell divides, are the progeny nervous too? Right?
You said it's not genetic.
It's not genetic.
Right? It's not genetic. No, but it's yes. What is it? So we'll talk about this in a minute. Okay. The second part of the experiment was to genetically. That's where I learned this molecular biology business. Is how to genetically engineer cells. And what I built was eight different strains of bacteria. In each strain of bacteria, I use a strain where the receptor is deleted. And I made a plasmid that has the receptor gene under the control of the lactose promoter. This means that when I add something that looks like sugar lactose to the medium, bacteria think that they have to activate all the lactose promoters, and therefore they activate the receptor. The more sugar I add, the more receptor is made. It's an experimental knob that allows you to play with the level of concentration of a given protein. So I did this with the receptor, the enzymes that add methyl groups and remove methyl groups, synthesis. The messenger gets phosphorylated, it goes to the motor. The kinase that phosphorylates it, and the enzyme that takes away the phosphates. And also, all of these at once, on one operon, the level of all of these, receptor and RFBYZ at once, and a strain where you can independently vary two, the one that adds messages and the one that removes messages. So all these strains. And then, for each strain like this, and this experiment where it's basically this experiment, but this is a steady state without attractants. This is when you add attractants, so you can think this could be glued here. When you add attractants, the tumbling is zero and then it adapts. Okay. It's this curve. And in each case, for each level of protein made inside the cell, a particular protein in this network made inside the cell, you can measure using Western gels the level effect. Measure steady state, the adaptation time to reach half steady state, and the precision of adaptation, which is the ratio between steady states without attractant and with saturated attractant. And if this is 1, this ratio, it means precise adaptation. And if it's less than 1 or more than 1, it means it's not precise adaptation. This is experiment. And here's, for example, the results when you vary the protein that adds methyl groups. It's a protein that is important for the adaptation of the receptors. If you take it away, there's no adaptation. So let's see. So what happens here? First of all, let's look at adaptation time. So how long it takes to adapt? Just like you predicted. When you change on this axis is how much of the protein there is on average in the population divided by how much there is in the wild type cells. So the cells make a certain amount of this protein. And using the gels, we just estimated the ratio of how much we're making with our knob compared to how much is made in the natural condition. And the adaptation time varies tremendously. When you have low PR, it takes 20 minutes to adapt. And when you have high PR, it takes a few seconds to adapt, 20 seconds. There's a huge variation. Definitely not a robust feature. It's a huge variation. You can see it very important. You've got to experiment. You have to wait 20 minutes, you have to wait 1 minute to feel it. Okay. Also, the steady state level, this level here. When you play with this PR, the more PR you have, the more methylated the receptors are, the more active they are, the more phosphorylated messenger, the more tumbles. Therefore, the more PR you have, the more the steady state level is. Also changes with... Yeah. But what doesn't change is the precision of adaptation. Which is, all these cells have precise adaptation. It's in the experimental area. Except for the cell where you delete it completely, it doesn't have adaptation at all. But when we're down to half the natural level, which is the lowest we got in cell, you have exact adaptation.
Still a little confusing. It sounds like each cell has its own unique fingerprint of a tumble per second time, which it always goes back to.
Right.
That must somehow be encoded in the set of all other protein banks in there. Somehow buffering.
Well, let's talk about this in the end. I think I agree. It's a great puzzle. And then I repeated this thing for all the components of the network. Like, for example, the receptor. You increase three times more than the natural level. The adaptation time changes by a factor of two. If you reduce the amount of messenger that goes to the motor, key wire, how many frequency goes down? The steady state goes down by a factor of two. If you delete the guy that takes away the phosphates, there's lots of phosphorylated PY, therefore the tumbling goes up fourfold. Steady state is very high, it tumbles all the time. And if you delete the enzyme that takes away methyl groups, there's a 50% increase in adaptation time and fourfold decrease in steady state, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these guys change the steady state and the adaptation time by a lot.
So it's by modulation in some of this that is responsible for the it's some modulation in CC or something like that.
Yeah,
that makes a variation between the cell.
Oh no, I'm not talking about the variation between the cells. Yeah. I'm just saying that changing the amount of any of the proteins makes this graph look really different. You know, they have the steady state higher and their tumbling frequency, they are taking time lower on average on the population. But what doesn't change is precise adaptation. The one thing that doesn't change when you change the levels of any of these proteins is precise adaptation precision. For some reason, it's the one thing that doesn't. It's always a precise adaptation. Okay, that's what we get from the experiment. Clear?
So how did you do that experimentally? Change the expression level?
Oh, so that's what I mentioned. I took strains that didn't have one of the proteins, X, on the chromosome, and I put it back on the plasmid with a promoter that's from a different gene that I can control, so it's sugar. Therefore, you have a knob and you can change on average how many proteins are made in the population. So why is this thing robust? Why is precision adaptation precision robust? Why are other features sensitive? Right? Why is adaptation precision robust? And why is adaptation time at the steady state sensitive and the adaptation time sensitive? So the truth is we don't really know what's so special about precise adaptation. And this is an interesting question for theoretical analysis. Why precise adaptation? But experimentally we have evidence that precise adaptation is essential for biological function of chemotaxis. And here's the evidence. It's
essentially the difference. Then we should search another molecule
than this one.
What? It sounds like it's independent of all these molecules that you have. So
yeah. No. You can, okay, so precise adaptation. So you can get one strain which doesn't have precise adaptation. And that's when you delete simultaneously two genes, KR and KB, the ones that methylate and demethylate the receptors, the ones that press the buttons. And when you delete both of them, and the receptors are made with two out of the four buttons pressed in an intermediate state. But there's no adaptation. And what happens is that when you do this, they only have partial adaptation. They have steady state, it's like normal cells, but they only have partial adaptation. It's given by another part of the system. And when you take a look at them and just make them swim up to food, they're awful. They're terrible at chemotaxis. But they look very similar. They don't have precise adaptation. They have less than 1% of the velocity of a population moving up on a typical food grid. They're terrible at chemotaxis. On the other hand, if you take the strains that we made that have exact adaptation, but we play with everything else, come to steady state and adaptation time by, you know, by a lot, threefold or fivefold changes, steady state and adaptation time, and you put them on a food gradient, they have chemotaxis that's comparable to the normal cells. Comparable is a factor of two less. Sometimes you can move better. Alright? So there's a big difference. The one mutant that doesn't have precise adaptation, it fails to perform the difference. But all these other mutants that have precise adaptation, but you know, very, very clumsy, or very non-clumsy, or adapt quickly, or adapt very slowly, they do fine. So, and the last point is that chemotaxis is displayed in many bacteria, and there's other species which have been studied as well as E. coli to give this kind of curve, and both of these species also have exact adaptation. But they have really different molecular mechanisms for achieving chemotaxis, but they both have exact adaptation.
This particular mutant,
if
you compare it to wild type or to the other mutants, what is there? Is there any other property in which they are very different?
Yeah, amplification, which is to say, if you put a small signal, you get a big response.
They don't have that.
They don't have that so much, and maybe this is related for some reason. So.
Because what bothers me about this argument is you made some manipulation, you produced a particular mutant,
right.
And then you say, well, precise that in this particular mutant there is no precise adaptation and there is no.
Well, it looks very similar.
Yeah,
in
no chemotaxis,
right.
And therefore you say,
no,
therefore.
I'm telling you.
It's essential for chemotaxis. I don't think that the title of this transparency follows from the.
I agree. It's evidence, that's it.
They're correlated.
The problem is you can't make it. We couldn't find out how to make a mutant. We couldn't find out how to make a mutant that doesn't have this feature.
What I'm trying to say is that you knock some essential function out, which destroys this ability and that ability,
right.
But it's not.
I agree. It could be that some other ability is destroyed here.
You could maybe come up with someone who is world champion in chemotaxis but doesn't.
I agree with you. But what is clear is that the other sensitive features aren't so important for chemotaxis.
Can you say a little bit more why? I mean, if you're just observing this thing, why is it so poorly in chemotaxis? Is it tumble too often? Or
no, it tumbles fine.
What makes it 1%?
I don't know what makes it 1%.
I mean, if you look at the trajectory, what does it
mean?
The trajectory does look like a random walk that's not biased.
So it doesn't matter.
It's biased
much less than.
Not biased.
It's a non biased parameter. So biased much less than what? Whereas these are a good biased parameter one. And I'm telling you, I don't understand. It's something that we don't understand why precise adaptation is important, whether precise adaptation is important. This is just the evidence to suggest that it's essential. I agree with you that since it's just one mutant, it can always be another reason. That's a very good point. That's a problem. So the next slide is only a hypothesis. The hypothesis is that this network is designed so that the essential feature and essential feature is robust, and non-essential features are sensitive to both. And then you can ask, is this a general feature of signaling networks? So you can do the same experiment to other systems, right? Basically, it's general. You can take, if you know all the proteins, you can take, make these plasmids, generate strains where the you can control the levels, measure the input-output relationship, see what's sensitive and what's not sensitive, and ask which features are robust and which features are fringe.
Is the tumble per second that an individual cell prefers correlated with its linear size?
No. But there is one interesting correlation that if you plot 1 over versus tumbling frequency in individual cells,
I thought the tumbling frequency was a constant in individual
cells. No, no, no. Okay. The steady state tumbling frequency changes between individual cells.
Right.
But the fact that it...
I see. As you change from cell to cell.
Yeah, it's changed from cell to cell. It's changed from cell to cell. Cell 1, cell 13, cell 24, cell 3. And this is a paper in 1974 by Koshland about cell-to-cell individuality in Texas.
But I thought you said that if in an individual cell, the adaptation time can range from 1 second to 10 minutes.
No. The 1 second to 10 minutes is what happens when you play with the stimulus. So when you give a centrifugal stimulus, it's all the time, it's minutes. So it could be 8 minutes or it could be 12 minutes.
I see. So that curve is for a fixed step.
Yeah, for fixed stimulus. And in fact, we understand this. We know why this happens. Okay, so here's the answer, I think. Or at least here's one suggestion for this individuality. So what's going on here? Why do we need this button? So it has to do with... Oh yes, Spurgeon Conference 76. This is the paper where they had this observation of the individuality of cells, the first time, the individuality of the protein. So here's the idea. Like we discussed in the previous talk, as you saw, the flagellar system, for instance, gets made, also the chemotaxis operons get made, the levels of proteins change, even during growth, on average over the population, they vary over a large amount. And also, at a single point, these genetically identical cells have different amounts of proteins inside. Because protein synthesis is a translation is a stochastic process. In particular, this one protein, TR, which is the lowest abundance protein in the network, a few tens per cell, probably, is expected to have large fluctuations, variations between cell to cell. And when you look at experiments, if you have low TR, cells have fewer methylated receptors and they don't tumble as much. And with this high TR, they tumble a lot. Mm-hmm. At the same time, cells with low TR have a long adaptation time. Cells with high TR have a short adaptation time, just the time you need to add more and more methyl groups in order to adapt, just proportional to the amount of TR. There just links these two features together. So you have to live with this aspect of biology, that you're making a circuit and the components are not reliable. The components, in particular the amount of proteins that you have is a big random variable. This component, if it was an electrical circuit and this was a capacitor, it comes from a factory where you have threefold tolerance in their capacitance. You have to make a circuit that works with this restriction. And the point is that both these cells, all these cells basically in a population, have chemotaxis. They go towards the food. Nobody gets left behind. So, if exact adaptation is really something that's essential for chemotaxis, then it's good to have this as the one feature that's built to be independent of all the protein levels.
I have two populations, the one on the left and the one on the right, and I put down some food. Will one lag behind, or will they?
Yeah, probably, yeah, because they, you know, there's an optimal. Here, you know, you optimize, but you can't make cells presumably all make 304 proteins.
Well, no, that's a hard experiment.
No, you can't make. You can't presumably design it.
Can you sort them? You can't sort.
Oh, you can sort them. Yeah,
you
didn't. Yeah. Sorry, you can make.
How do you sort them?
You attach GFP to these proteins, protein, and then use a transactor cell sorter.
So, am I correct in thinking that the QR concentration, though, is inheritable?
Oh, so it's inheritable in the sense that when cells divide, half goes to one cell and half goes to another cell. So
but
if the mother cell
needs to cast a calf in half.
It's a stochastic half and half. So in this point of view, and also if you imagine this cell has some for some reason, a reduced rate of protein synthesis, and QR levels will be low. And you know, since every protein is fluctuating in this, and it's a highly connected nonlinear system, and everything, it's easy to imagine that cells will be stuck in different attractors because of these fluctuations. So some cell will be a little faster, some cell will be a little slower, just because of proteins. So it's not genetic heritability, or it's not genetic, you understand?
If it were heritable over long enough time scales, you could select on it and...
I don't think it's over very long time scales. Even though there are features where cells bacteria differentiate into two subpopulations with a very low switching rate. So 100 generations, they're stuck in one. And there's really molecular mechanisms that allow you to do that.
Incredible. At what rate do these cells make QR? I mean, it's a conserved enzyme, so it must degrade.
It doesn't degrade. It just made and gets diluted up and cells divide. And it's just made in an RNA is produced, it binds ribosomes at a certain rate. And in fact, its ribosome binding site is very weak.
So if it divides less rapidly, the QR concentration goes up.
Right. And this is another example, right, that you can't count in this concentration. I think the point here is that you, when you make a model of a biological mechanism, I think it's important to take into account, to understand what's the central feature of the model that's important for biology. You know, take into account this fact that you have to tolerate the parameters can change between cell to cell, both the reaction rates and the protein concentrations. And I think this should place a limitation whereby some of the models you come up with based on everything that's known, you read in the papers, will be not robust and then you can discard them or, you know.
Do I understand that the gist of the earlier experiments that you described was if I take the cell on the left and I just remove half the TRs, it will, after some time, return to the same humble per second that it had before?
No.
Only change the stimulants, not the internal variables.
It's a little bit complicated.
I know.
The robustness, I thought, implied insensitivity to changing the numbers of
key outputs. No, it's not that. Right, it's robustness. No, but of what? The question is robustness of what? The one that's robust here is exact adaptation.
I see. So the steady state humble per second.
Oh, that makes the drugs. So here's one cell with a certain concentration of QR, QB, QY, QZ, all these parameters.
Yeah.
It behaves like this. And it has exact adaptation. Here's another cell where we double QR. It has a higher steady state, faster adaptation.
I see.
The cell returns to the same steady state. In this particular experiment where we're adding effects. That's the point. So in a population, you have a cell like this, a cell like this, a cell like this, a cell like this. Each one has their own character, but they all have this exact adaptation, which we don't understand exactly why.
So given an ensemble of these key enzymatic proteins, there's an ideal.
Oh, there's an optimum.
An optimal idle speed.
Yeah, there's an optimum, and presumably they're designed so that the average is close to this optimum. And in fact, it looks that way because when we when we use our strains which have more or less of each protein, we did the swimming assay, it was true that the wild type, the natural occurring one, was more or less the best. So, sometimes it was a little better, but it wasn't like you can easily find concentrations that are much, much better. So it's an example. So we just use the system to ask a systems question. And it has a lot of other features that are interesting and not understood. One of them is an amplifier, where if you make a small, small, small step, which is to say that a few out of 1,000 receptors get bound by attractant, you get an almost complete response. And somewhere in the circuit is an amplifier. It's not currently understood where. And that's an open question. Where is the amplifier?
You said that you will sketch the theoretical model.
Oh yeah, I can sketch a theoretical model. Can you choose it?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Yeah, and again, if anybody wants to leave, don't worry about it. Okay, there's different kinds of mechanisms which are fine-tuned for adaptation, but this is the simplest one. It's a linear model. And this was, here are some references. And in this model,
by model, there's some set of differential equations associated with those cells.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a set of differential equations. And in the simplest case, there's four species of receptors. This is a kind of an abstraction where they can be either methylated or unmethylated, bound. Unmethylated and non-methylated. Now, the methylated guys are active in the sense that they cause tumbling. So tumbling frequency is some alpha times the concentration of this species, and some smaller alpha times the concentration of this species. Because attraction binding reduces tumbling. We have attracted these stop tumbling. Two alphas here, these two arrows are different. So how do you get so what happens? When you add attractants, you move here quickly, and therefore, since this arrow is smaller, you tumble less. So that's the response. Now, on a slow time scale, how do you adapt? You see this arrow here is strong, and this arrow here is small, it's very small. Therefore, when you move here, now on a slow time scale, the concentration of here you had a few of these because the return arrow is small. So when you add attractant, you have a few. But now this arrow is small again, so naturally you'll get more and more and more. You get more times a smaller coefficient, so you recover tumbling frequency. You understand? But this is fine-tuned, because the amount of this arrow here at this rate is smaller than this rate. It has to be balanced, so the amount of this rate is larger than this rate. This is fine-tuned. If you want to return exactly, you have to balance two different things. Activity of this enzyme with activity of this species. And indeed, it's fine if you write these models and compare experimental data, you get a nice fit. But in the fit, you really have two numbers, and if you change them by 20%, you have a 20% lack of exact adaptation.
Is there feedback in the simple model?
It's kind of feedback.
But the phosphorylated key Y doesn't seem to be.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, this feedback here, it turns out, is not essential. It's we even did an experiment where we knocked out a feedback here. Genetically, it didn't affect exactly the
same. Have you knocked out that feedback without it?
I knocked it. This protein key V has two domains.
Okay.
One domain does this. The other domain gets phosphorylated.
Okay.
And we just cut off this domain. And it still works. But it doesn't get regulated. So what's a fine? What's the model that has this robust? Nama Bakai Stan Leibniz model. They had to make a brave assumption, biochemical assumption. The biochemical assumption is that this enzyme, when the receptor, when it's methylated, has two states, active and inactive, through which it makes rapid transitions. When attractants bind, they stabilize the inactive state, therefore there's less tumbling. Now here's the key thing.
The attractant is the star.
This is active, receptor star, or inactive. The attractant just makes the arrow larger than you. Now here's the key assumption, that a biochemical assumption, prediction, if you can want, is what makes the molecule robust, is that the enzyme that removes the methyl groups doesn't work on just any methylated receptor, but only on ones which are in their active conformation. So the receptor is in one conformation, it's active, another conformation, it's inactive. And only when it's in the active conformation, it presents this methyl group in a way that enzyme can work on. This wasn't made before in another model. We don't need this assumption. In other models, TB just comes to any methylated receptor, takes away the methyl groups. Here, it's especially, it's hard to measure because we can't really see these states, they're so fast. You can't really measure, or you can, but nobody's ever done it. It's a key assumption that this enzyme only works in the active state, and this makes a very positive, powerful feedback. It's been mapped to what's called the integral feedback in engineering. It appears in all the lights in this room. Engineers use it thousands of times in building and airplanes. It's a very common engineering approach. Okay, so why is this now a robust model? Okay, so first let's go through the behavior. I put on attractants. Attractants stabilize the states. So there's more inactive receptors and there's less tumbles. Attractants. But there's less active receptors, therefore there's less removal of methyl groups, just addition. Therefore the amount just keeps growing. This little arrow increases this until you recover steady state, because the steady state is a balance between this constant arrow and this arrow, which is the multiplication of this rate times this. So it's always locked to a steady state where the number of active receptors times this activity is equal to this. That's locked. It doesn't depend on that term. So it's really simple to see it mathematically. The nice thing I think about what Nama and Stan did was they took these 200 biochemistry papers and reduced it to something as simple as this. Really a toy model that's very, very, very simple. You can understand things from it.
The biology, that's fairly difficult to sell. I mean, and that kind of simplification that leaves out all the details, something we love as physicists, I mean,
right.
The biological community...
Yeah, but still, you know, it's the proof is in the pudding. I mean, if you... There's two ways to look at it. First of all, at this point, there could be a robust system. Led me to believe that it's worth spending 2 years on this experiment and trying to see it. What I'm saying is, first of all, it's very important, the role of theory here, I think, is fundamentally, it's not to understand a context, it's just to make a new concept. New, of course, it's not a new concept, nothing is new under the sun, robustness was talked about before, but in this world of signal transduction, it's a new idea.
What exactly is the new concept? This is what I'm trying to understand.
You have the equation?
Sure, yeah, it's sent into this paper right here, the rules. But we can also write it on the blackboard.
What's conceptually new here? This is what I try to understand. It's not that somehow didn't come across clearly in the talks I heard so far. And before they wrote down there were four states, okay, on some level, with all kind of arrows between them. Each arrow carries a rate constant.
Right.
And then there is an assumption that two
arrows are the same, or yeah.
To tumble, and one of these, this one doesn't tumble. And now you write a differential equation, and that's play with the variables and do something comes out.
And this comes out.
Now here I see three states and arrows between them, and one says tumble, and
it's a different topology.
It's a different topology.
It's a topology such that this remarkable robustness of the...
It's somehow built in, I think.
Yeah, it's built in, yeah, yeah.
That was my impression, that
it's built in.
Sort of design.
No, it's by design. It was looking for the possible model that does it. It wasn't hard, easy to find.
So I can now play with all the arrows here.
Yeah,
and
you can play with all the arrows here.
And it will end up
with... When you play with the arrows...
Unlike the other set of arrows.
So somehow in this model, they constructed in a way that there is a single, no matter what parameters you play with, I think there is a single attractor for the steady-state tumbling frequency.
Well, that's independent of the... I mean, this is very, it's very, like, you're not allowed to add arrows. This is very, it's like, it's not what you like in physics when you say, you know, in physics you like something to say a model is robust if we can add a little bit of arrow here. It's still, it's not like this, okay?
The fixed point only depends on the gradient of the
fixed point,
right?
That's does depend on this input parameter.
Right, it only depends on its
right, gradient. But I mean, you do not allow...
The fixed point only does depend on this input parameter. Yeah. Try to build a model where the fixed point of this very internal variable doesn't depend on the fixed point of this particular...
And the value of that parameter.
And this is an external parameter that you vary, so you change it. And this always goes back to the same number.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I change the numbers here, that steady state number changes, right? The thing is, when I make a step change of this guy, it always returns to.
So you need a differentiator, right?
It's a differentiator, right? Okay. It's a differentiator, except it doesn't go to a zero baseline. And in engineering, it's quite easy to build a robust differentiator.
I could write that on a first order differential equation.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But the whole key is to get it out.
No, but when you try to build it out of a chemical reaction, it's very difficult. It's not trivial at all. And in particular, if you try to put in all the constraints that you know.
What if I add an arrow going from this inactive state to that one, and another arrow going from there to that one?
Now, for instance, if PB also works on this one.
I mean, just add two more arrows.
Yes, you ruin it.
Ruin it. So this means that this is extremely fine-tuned, because you have to set
extremely fine-tuned to adding new chemical reactions. That's right.
No. Some of the K values are tuned to zero.
Exactly. No, that's okay. So that's what I'm saying. It's a very biological thing. What's the main source of noise here? The main source of noise is fluctuations in the amounts of proteins, and fluctuations in non-zero rate constants. For instance, but enzymes are so specific that having a new reaction is very low probability. So it's very important to know what's robust against what. So it's really close to an engineering robustness problem, where you always know what the sources of noise are and what your components are. You try to build a circuit that's robust. There's something about it that's robust with respect to certain fluctuations. And really, it's very hard. It's hard to find a model like this, and you have to make very specific molecular assumptions.
You have a figure from the Nature paper where they change the kinetic coefficients, which are non-zero by a random type.
I don't have that here, but what happens is that the way they drew it was. The way they drew it is if you write here the fold change. Log k nu over k zero
sigma
over all the parameters. And here you draw something like adaptation time. You get... But if you draw precision of adaptation...
So what they plot horizontally is a set of changes that they've made in all the non-zero rate constants associated with those arrows. Where they double it, they quadruple it, they divide by 8.
Right.
And you sum up all these changes, and you go further and further from your original model with the given topology.
Yeah.
With the given?
With the fixed.
Right.
Topology.
So you've got the zero is left zero.
The zeros are left zero. Right. Yeah.
And then what happens?
And then what happens is that some features like adaptation time really open up.
Right.
Whereas the adaptation precision of adaptation
For each new gram, yes. You're doing this experiment. Like,
yeah.
It looks like it starts to open up after a while, but there's a big range where it's mathematically it's one. So you can break it if you go far, far, far. For instance, if the rate of key R becomes bigger than key B, there's all kind of limits to where it works. Mm-hmm. So this is the. It's a trivial thing, but I think I found it illuminating that you can take the same biochemistry, converse chemical constraints, and write a model that really has kind of this clever feedback loop that changes qualitatively the.
And is there any experiment one could do to prove the hypothesis that in this particular system there's an inactive state?
Yeah.
And that would be a real triumph for the theory.
I agree. Yeah. We did one experiment that could have disproved this. It didn't. What I mentioned before. This guy was regulated by the phosphorylation. And when we chopped out the part that gets regulated by phosphorylation, making this a weaker enzyme, still functional, there was still exact adaptation. And the only thing you can think of, but it's still regulated. It's known that this piece is still regulated. That's to say, if you put on attractants, now it stops demanding working. So the only possibility that we can think of how this is regulated is by the state of its substrate. But this is not really proof, so I don't know. This is a challenge, experimental challenge, and there exist mutants which are locked in this state and locked in this state. So maybe that's a way to measure it. But it's really now, I think, experimental physicists. These transitions occur on the scale of a sub-millisecond scale. And if you can get a handle on how to do an experiment like that, it would be beautiful.
Is it known? In sort of level of crystal structures, what the two states look like?
No, people haven't been able to crystallize the receptor yet, because it's a membrane protein, it's hard to do.
Right.
On a mechanistic level, it raises an interesting, just like you say, it would be very good if you could prove it.
For the same model, could you add something or whatever to look at its real chemotactic ability and to really connect these two? I mean, okay, this model, when you build it, it has the nice feature of robustness. Does it also mean that it's a good...
A good chemotactic?
Chemotactic.
Yeah, it works well, with the exception that we don't understand the amplification. So on small gradients, no model works well, as well as the bacteria. But on reasonable gradients, it works perfectly fine. Simulated bacteria go up to the mass, look fine.
Can you show me an example of what you mean by bad adaptation?
Well, partial adaptation.
It only comes back partially?
Yeah.
Or does it make mistakes? Or does it only just mean?
It comes back to a different steady state level. Or a higher, or either higher or lower. That's partial adaptation. And
but the next time, say you kicked it twice. Okay, so now it's sitting at this new level, and you kick it again. Is it?
Oh, yeah. So when we
just randomly pick another level, or
no. Okay, so it's
systematic.
It picks a different level.
It would just pick a random different level.
No, it's systematic.
Systematic is low.
Like half. So maybe you go way away from the optimal behavior.
But isn't that, if something actually did that, it would eventually not be a very good,
That's not fair, because right? Eventually a point
in the line. I agree, but the thing is that even when you put in a saturating effect, it doesn't go all the way to zero. It goes halfway or so.
If it keeps on, at some point it'll stop happening things.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe if it's in a situation where you gradually increase attractants, then it gets stuck at zero. And then it would explain why you really need to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And we never thought of that. So
yeah, it would be very bad if you adapt your picture.
Yeah.
You run out of
you run out of space. Yeah, that's right. So.
Yeah, thank you very much.